Hello, Stephen. I'd like to have a conversation with you about drugs and solitude. Your latest book, The Art of Solitude, is my favorite among all your books, and I've read them all, except for The Tibet Guide, which I've never had occasion to use, and I reckon never will have, certainly not in this time of COVID. The others, though, have been extremely helpful, as I am also a Buddhist of secular faith, and in this aspect especially, I thank you for your informed guidance and encouragement. Over the years, beginning when I took refuge in Tibetan Buddhism in the early 1990s in Winnipeg, I was very lucky to have your deservedly popular book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, which provided a counterbalancing refuge within my almost entirely Western Sangha. Almost all of them were believers in reincarnation, magical powers, and the panoply of supernatural beings. In my later middle age, my then wife and I moved to Toronto, and there I joined a sangha of Korean Zen lineage. Coincidentally, same as you, going from Tibetan Buddhism to Korean Zen. And speaking of coincidences, somewhere you wrote, maybe in Confession of a Buddhist Atheist, a book which really helped me too, particularly in illuminating the revolutionary quality of the Buddhist doctrine and practice, and in unpacking some of my ambivalence in respect to Zen and Theravada. Not dissimilar to yours, I don't think, and this book also was a reminder of the centrality of ethics to Buddhism. And in this, it was totally an inspiration to me, particularly in the sometimes challenging situations that arise for a secular Buddhist in a community of individuals who, again, are mostly seeking something out there, usually a salvific attainment of enlightenment. I lived for 8 years in a Zen temple. But about coincidences, I was saying, you mentioned maybe in this book that you were born in 1953, same year as me. And now, in The Art of Solitude, there's this chapter where you're describing your experiences with psychedelics and recounting Aldous Huxley's taking mescaline in May of 1953, which you say was the month after you were born. And now I'm thinking, April, huh? You weren't by any chance born on April the 9th. We met in person at a four-day workshop in Toronto, presented by you and Martine Batchelor, who I assume is your wife. I brought an all-but-one collection of your books, about two a day, for you to sign. Great workshop, by the way. Thanks again. I can't remember the year, but probably it was sometime in the first half of the years I lived in the Toronto Zen Buddhist Temple. I'm still with this group as an elder in the Sangha, and also for some years now, the chair of the temple's board of directors. For me, it was all pretty accidental how I became associated with Korean Zen, with our founding teacher and director, the Venerable Samu Sunim. It was not because of him personally or the Korean aspect that I joined there, more like because it was handily located near the residential addictions treatment facility that I was in. I'm more of a Canadian Buddhist. I'm as Buddhist as possible under the circumstances. Anyway. Apparently, Martine did have some personal connection to Sunim, I guess from when she was a nun in Korea. And so I ended up setting up a temple visit for her, and that included walking her over there. And two other people came along, a nice young couple, a local sort of yoga guru and his very nice girlfriend. The guy's name was Michael Stone. Before I got to the part in The Art of Solitude where you mentioned the late Michael Stone, and I already had talked with my wife, my second wife. My first wife divorced me when I was in that treatment place. Not the first time I'd been in addictions treatment. This was actually the last time, but nobody could have guessed that. I was saying, before I got to the place in your book where you mention our mutual acquaintance, I'd already told my wife about my idea of writing an open letter to you. She was very pleased about me doing this. I've been going through a rough patch after I had very disgracefully relapsed, had a slip, whatever, an egregious surprise that happened over 8 days when she was away and I was home, alone, and more or less in pandemic lockdown. I did not relapse to crack, which was what had got me into the six-month treatment program and out of my third-year marriage 15 years ago. Just pot. I can hear her saying, not just pot, John. Okay, not just pot. Moreover, along with this drug I'd confected typically for me, used it together with online porn. And again in my head, I hear her voice. She was so angry. And again, you go to the porn. How could you? Okay. That was last winter. We've been married for 5.5 years. Now it's like 6.5. And so, yeah, I've given this relapse in this letter to you a lot of thought. Because my addictions to sex and cocaine ended my first marriage, which had been remarkably calm and secure for nearly 30 years. Anyway, on this morning, in the middle of last winter, walking with my second wife, I mentioned your book and my inclination to write you a letter. In those days, we were walking together most mornings, having hugely hard talks, disagreeing a lot. But we were totally in agreement in our discouragement with one of the chapters of The Art of Solitude that are about you taking drugs, which I'd read in bed the night before. Might not have been in bed. Could have been downstairs on the sofa or on my cot in my study. Last winter was not a happy time for us, largely due to my relapse. She knows you're like some kind of exemplar to me, a valued teacher. Your wisdom from afar and aloft, but we're definitely contemporaries. We have a few things in common, and you are a very good teacher. And in my state, humiliated by my relapse, it had been discouraging and disheartening to read. This is not your problem, about how you sometimes still enjoy smoking pot. You'd enjoyed it when you were young, as had I. And you write now about how you can walk through an art gallery, seeing the art so feelingly, the doors of perception opened by some psychoactively grand defamiliarization. That's my word for it, defamiliarization. And I can't be sure, but I think that's what you're talking about. Not just the highly pleasurable buzz, but what is for you a usefully altered mental state, maybe like a warm boot for the brain. It's not surprising, therefore, that you mention your respect for Canada's legalization of cannabis. Well, yeah, but I'd add that I see lots of changes. Within walking distance of my Toronto home, there are several dispensaries, and their doors have stayed open throughout the pandemic. In fact, new doors have opened up. Business seems to be booming. There are half a dozen pot shops between my house and the nearest McDonald's. My neighborhood's not rich enough for a Starbucks. You also write about how you've occasionally gone globally tripping on psychedelics and ayahuasca. Maybe I want to talk about that too. And of course, you can have a glass of wine, which my wife's first and second also have with dinner. For a while, I was an alcoholic. Interesting though, after taking ayahuasca, you quit alcohol, from which you'd abstained while you were for many years a monk, but resumed when you left that life and got married. And for me, my drinking ended with the cocaine affair that wrecked my marriage. But yeah, no, I mean, it's all okay for you, but my second wife and I were thinking here, could your good trip story be framed in a way that would be without the harmful influence on people like me? People whose lives, yeah, no, never mind, I had a bad trip in the summer of love, 1967. Bummer. 40 years of addictions. Much of that time hardcore. And actually, it's really boring, like most people's addiction stories. Mine's just not very interesting. Just a lot of bad luck. Mine, not yours, eh? But then, a few chapters further on in your new book, you recall Michael Stone's fatal overdose on fentanyl. And that's when I think, okay, Stephen, it's not just for me and my wife that I want to strike up a conversation now with you about taking drugs. You write that you're wondering whether if by observing the Buddhist precept of abstinence, you might have been a better example to him. You said you'd wish that you'd gotten in touch with him because he was your friend. I didn't know you were friends. I'm sorry. Yeah, I know the feeling when I'm thinking I should reach out to someone and then suddenly it's too late. People I know who knew Michael were shocked. It was really sad. He's gone. Sheer bad luck. But luckily, we're still here. Me, I'm amazingly lucky to be here. Several people I know have died of drug overdoses in this other epidemic. Michael Stone's misfortune was that he was a person with bipolar disorder. And there's a stigma, especially in the New Age yoga world. And under the pressures of professional and domestic responsibilities, he very privately sought the relief of medication. British Columbia's healthcare system was not satisfactorily responsive, but illegal sources are especially easily accessed there. I can imagine that the historical Buddha Siddhartha Gautama in his youth might have done something similarly stupid. He described his youthful self as most delicate. Whatever, only a hopelessly narrow reading of the precept against intoxicants precludes pharmaceuticals for the treatment of a mental health condition. But pot, psychedelics, alcohol, and stimulants are typically different, and I think that the choice to use them is problematic. Caffeine's okay, I think, and I drink coffee every morning with my writing. I wish we could sharpen up a spiritual perspective on a wise and compassionate use of psychoactive products for our time, and not come off sounding like monks or aged hippies. Also not be too specifically focused on lifelong addicts like me, for whom the chemical hooks in most of these substances makes them very much not worth it. I have a genetic predilection, and early life trauma, and since then a history. And so for me, abstinence definitely works best. My past and present wives and family, friends, various cohorts in my communities, they all heartily agree. I feel that they are in a way empathetic, but not entirely accurately empathetic. And because for most people, the decision to not use is a lot less obvious than for longtime drug addicts like me, I think that the accuracy of our empathy is hugely important and difficult because it has to do not only with drugs, but with a necessarily wide take on addictions, and therefore, I believe, on relationships. Because I really don't think we can talk about addictions and not be talking about relationships. Not once in The Art of Solitude do you mention you're being married. You've never written about your relationships or taking drugs in any of your previous books. For me, with what I have to share, reticence on either topic would just not make sense. Your Buddhist books don't need these disclosures. Now, in other cases with other Buddhist teachers, it's different. For example, Alan Watts and Chogyam Trungpa were alcoholics. And since finding that out, and not from them, their writings have felt less truthful to me. The lifelong boozing killed Trungpa Rinpoche. He was only 48, and his end was ignominious. Such things in the lives of our spiritual teachers are of more than passing interest. Siddhartha, the historical Buddha, on the day his wife gave birth to their child, walked out, left the family home. Although not before naming the baby Rahula, which in English is fetter. What am I supposed to make of that? I don't get why people don't ask questions, don't want to talk about these situations. Michael Stone left a pregnant wife and their three children. Where are the before and after Buddhists in this situation? I have one son and two young granddaughters. My wife is a devoted daughter, dear big sister, and adored aunt. Every family is an interweaving process. The word family should be a verb. How can there not be questions, conversation? Except that I know that even just sharing my story of drug taking, not to mention the stuff around sex, I mean even trying to just start up a conversation without harming my loved ones is really hard, currently and especially with regards to my wife. There's stigma, for sure. And yet for very sure, admitting to the suffering that my behavior causes others is pretty darn close to the empathetic bullseye. So I think that when we talk about recreational drugs, the conversation has to recognize the harms of addiction and acknowledge mental illness. I need to speak from my experience. And for sure, I also have to believe that people can use my story, many other stories, and maybe in some sense and at some level yours too, to work through the issues, including not only individual mental health and addiction challenges, but also the effect of our behavior around drugs and sex on the people in our lives. Relationships are essential to everyone. Unlike recreational drugs, which only some people get into, although the numbers are going up for casual consumers and for addicted users, it seems to me that voluntarily chosen solitude is vanishingly rare, or becoming so. I think that it's really interesting how drug-taking and solitude are both very significantly social. A drug trip, even if undertaken in isolation, will amplify the voices in the head. And sober seclusion does the same. The mind evokes the voices of others. You describe this very well in your book, how when we go inside ourselves, we meet others, and how distinctions can be lost between people who are remembered, people who are entirely fantasized, and those who are actually in proximity. Drugs eliminate solitude and dispel silence. I recollect how it felt like the stoner society was crowding me out, sometimes weirding me out, stampeding and trampling me. Whatever, for better or for worse, we're wired for togetherness. And if we want the experiences to be for the better, whether we're on drugs or not, we have to be rightly attentive to the march of this inside-out parade. Another aspect we need to pay attention to, which you also describe in your accounts of drug taking, is the frame of higher concerns in which both drug trips and silent retreats are shared. Right before taking peyote in Mexico or ayahuasca in Spain, your cohort assembled in a circle, with each participant telling everyone what they came for. I believe that a group's shared intentionality is key to working up the spiritual quality of the experience. Whether this experience be the sacred rituals of indigenous origins in which you ingested ayahuasca, and vomited a lot into transformation are the crack houses in which I smoked and injected cocaine and ejaculated a lot. Albeit mostly I did it in my own abode and alone, although always online and often also with one or occasionally two other people, like crack whores obsessively shooting selfies. But it's the same difference. Multiple personality minds and bodies let loose and acting out in cultural circumstances that are embedded with belief in shared purpose. First time I had sex at a love-in when I was 14, same summer you were 14, I was on LSD. And again, then, about 10,000 times. I bet I did more acid than Timothy Leary and Ram Dass put together. Ram Dass, or in Richard Alpert. April 6th, did you know that us Aries are the least likely of all signs to believe in astrologies? I digress. Way more acid I did. And for me, it became some strange kind of aphrodisiac, just saying, reading in your book about how their forerunner, Aldous Huxley, requested his loving second wife to give him LSD as a sacrament on his deathbed, I was reminiscing about my communions with those girls, sometimes two at a time, and all of us trying to synchronize our orgasms with the crack cocaine rush. We loved each other too, in a way, a very, very temporary way. Choice of soundtracks in these scenarios is crucial. T.S. Eliot wrote of music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts. Can any of this mysticism be married to moral and ethical principles? I ask you, Stephen. My misguided history shouldn't be all what begs my question here. I mean, I might fantasize that I'm doing acid with Eliot and Heidegger and me, the Canadian Buddhist. I'd be like saying, yeah, no, but don't you think the sort of liberal government we have in my country aligns more nicely with an ethical secular faith than that Hitler thing you guys are into? And what is it, spiritual freedom anyway, eh? I'd ask. And then maybe say that whatever it is, might a secular faith be maybe just like somehow actually better than full-on being in a state of rapture, despite how good that feels? I don't know. I might say that. And, you know, I really don't know, because when the most inspired poet and the highest philosopher are bearing the light on the path, it seems really tactless, not to mention totally a buzzkill to bring up thieving and murdering politics. But still, Stephen, you and me, we're old guys now, and you're definitely still, as one ought to be, an explorer who I'll keep on following. Here or there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity, for a further union, a deeper communion, through the dark cold and the empty desolation, said Eliot. And about that he was right on. And Heidegger's philosophy was right on. But the politics of both these men was certainly dubious. Whatever, we really don't know how things are going to play out, what myths and morals will prevail. I'm still feeling the depths of the Canadian winter. The last one was my worst ever, and I hope, Dale, this one won't be more. The whole thing coming on, too, spending our time locked down, this pandemic wearying, and draining us. Drugs, ethics, and religion. I don't know what to think, what to do. Because I really still wonder what mind-altering drug experiences might have to do with spirituality, freedom, and faith. One thing we do know is that it's not possible to get high in a drug that doesn't have an endogenous counterpart, pre-installed in the brain by biological evolution. Cannabis releases natural endocannabinoids. We have opioid receptors triggering the release of our endorphins for fentanyl, heroin, and other opiates and alcohol. For oxys, we have the hormonal neurotransmitter oxytocin. Cocaine serves up a neural cocktail that starts with my getting a big shot of my very own dopamine. And psychedelics have, well, I don't think we know what all they have, and research has only belatedly got going again. Anyway, the exogenous substances facilitate the experience. They don't invent it. Drug makes it happen, but the potentiality is innate. But whatever, taking the drug means that you don't have to work at it, don't have to practice anything. A lie if we arrive, fit as a fiddle, fully prepped for full-on play. To play, or to be played. Pharmacists make sure you know how to take your prescription safely. They're interested in your wellness, unlike the Hell's Angels who don't care. And I didn't get any sense one way or the other of the feelings towards customers from the kids working at the Cannabis Canada Express Canada delivery service. The exchange of money for product was through a half-closed door and masks were mandatory. We just purchased some amount and let it lever the chemicals found in our brains, with the result that some people, a lot of people who are like me, will get so egregiously good at consuming these mood-altering products as to almost always attain a very desirable outcome, doing something that's inherently easy and learning to make it quite obviously necessary. Do people who've never smoked pot know how strong the high is? This is not a coffee with an extra shot of espresso in the morning at your desk. This is not a couple of glasses of wine over a period of 3 hours, starting in your kitchen after work, proceeding through the dining room and eventually landing in the den. This is that amount of time feeling intense physical pleasure and an amazing change of mental state that for the average person can no way be maintained without drugs. Multiply by at least an order of magnitude for the power of drugs other than cannabis, drugs which are readily available thanks to large corporations and multinational syndicates. Recreational drugs may not be inebriating like alcohol, but being less inept doesn't mean that the user is not totally batshit stoned. And the way that worked for me was that for most of my 40 years addicted, I really worked at it. And for the longest time, I appeared to get away with it, to be a guy on his game. In my teens, instead of going to high school, I played guitar relatively successfully. And even after I stopped making music, I continued to be creative and productive, sort of. I definitely stayed active, presenting myself as an independent individual, a free-living young man, marching into middle age to a different drummer, seemingly able to routinely recreate my body mind as a mystic rapture machine. But what I was doing was teaching myself to get addicted and stay addicted. I was an ironic reference to spiritual freedom, immersed in a counterculture that upheld my continually intoxicating myself. My in-crowd was a caricature of a faith community. My average brain, like all human brains, evolved to be a social organ in a culturally defined organism. We are born prepared for sociability, and we develop into it throughout our lives. And herein lies our capabilities for freedom and for addictions. We have very liberative capacities for loving kindness and altruism, but we also have a potential for an intense self-centeredness, concomitant with which is the autodidactic entrapment of addictions. And now we're in with social media, and with neurofeedback coming on, and real artificial intelligence, more than the current well-learned machines may have on the horizon. Oh, there be monsters here. In the uncharted oceans at the edge of the inner and yet very sociable world. Navigating it will be terribly challenging. We need wise and compassionate spiritual teachers and guides. In The Art of Solitude, you write, "By taking cannabis as a monk, I learned that such substances generate a power in one's mind that is neither good nor bad in itself. What matters is whether or not you have the ability to turn this power to your own ends instead of being overwhelmed by it. In my case," you go on, this required that I first achieve a degree of self-governance through mastering a contemplative discipline rooted in a philosophical and ethical vision. And beginning in the next paragraph, you say, "I also learned that such self-medication is as much about enhancement of performance as the elimination of painful feelings. I found that cannabis was best taken in solitude and silence while in a clear and untroubled state of mind." Well, good for you, Stephen, for your enhancement of performance following your philosophically and ethically rooted mastery. But what can we say to people other than highly disciplined monks who want to know what to do when it comes to drug taking? Those of us for whom a clear and untroubled state of mind, even a little silence now and again, is just not happening. A contemplative community augmented by scholarly peers is not the reality that most people inhabit. In my world, people will turn your words around to suggest that you are advocating drugs as the path to untroubled clarity. Easy peasy switcheroo here. 3 years after legalization, the Canadian government is now deciding on rules for advertising. whether to allow cannabis dealers to be freed as for alcohol or restricted like with cigarettes. If I had a pot dispensary, I'd love to put a poster of a Buddhist monk in the window, like you maybe, with a quote in a cloud coming out of your mouth, the words, "I learned that such self-medication is as much about enhancement of performance as the elimination of painful feelings. I found that cannabis was best taken in solitude and silence while in a clear and untroubled state of mind." Further to which, my entrepreneurial self is now imagining a line of calming merchandise, maybe even seeing an opportunity to open up a chill space for my customers' uninterrupted using. We'll see what happens. But I expect that plentiful supply will match an easily grown demand, and I wouldn't be surprised to see advertising promoting performance enhancement marketed to people in solitude, a euphemism for involuntary and sad aloneness, and the high will be described as a glimpse of the summit of enlightenment. I'm saying that the purchase is not enhancement of anything good. It's typically self-medication as a futile attempt to relieve the fear and pain of disconnected lives, lonely hearts, and undernourished souls. The techniques for turning the power of the intoxicant to wholesome creative purposes, which you have achieved through your self-described lifelong practice leading to mastery, will not figure in corporate business plans, because addicted customers are the most profitable kind, and anything that treats the pain of loneliness is bound to cause addictions. Raw money power reigns. Late-stage capitalism chews and spits culture, and young people today don't even have my generation's flower-powered counterculture with its benevolence of great guitars and vocals. Although back then, we didn't really have much of a true discipline's philosophical and ethical vision, I must admit. In a lot of ways, we were just lucky, and now that luck seems like it's running out. And what my experience suggests to me is that we should be very, very careful what we say now about the goodness of taking drugs. Basically, because average brains like mine are just all too easy to hack. I have been a practicing Buddhist, meditating daily, and occasionally attending retreats, etc., for almost 30 years. And before this recent relapse, I didn't drink or take drugs for nearly 15 years. And for the first half of that time, I lived in a Zen monastery. Abstinence had ceased to be a problem for me. Renunciation felt more like freedom from addictions than deprivation. I'm shocked that I slipped, and I'm appalled at the harm my wife is still suffering today because many months ago, while she was away, I spent 8 days and nights getting stoned. In your book, you describe psychoactive products as medicine. Many times, that's how you refer to them. Medicine? When your shaman guide gives you a dose, you ask him, "If this is a medicine, then what is it curing?" And he answers, "A closed heart." End of chapter. By my reckoning, that quote should be at the beginning of a very interesting new chapter. Because when I read it, I wanted to go to this man's home and yours, and I wanted to ask you both in front of your families to tell me, what is not enough right here? What is there about right here that is not more than enough to cure and curate a closed heart? What is not enough about an ordinary, everyday mind in the company of our loved ones? What's preventing the heart from opening here without making expensive and deeply fraught purchases? Opening is, after all, just exactly what the heart naturally wants to do for free, isn't it? We attend retreats, sit in silence, and sometimes in solitude, to heal and open our hearts. People in our lives might misunderstand and liken it to escape, but just compare the mountain of evidence for well-being following sincere and sober contemplative practice in contrast to the vast and deep pit of suffering caused by drug taking. Medicines are prescribed by doctors according to medical science for the treatment of illness and injury. The promotion of OxyContin was a transgression, and one way for a government to engage in society's drug problem is to do what British Columbia and other jurisdictions are doing, to sue Purdue Pharma, busting the executive's asses, making these drug pushers pay a share of the healthcare bills. Meanwhile, in Canada and elsewhere, repurposing pot smokers from criminals into taxpayers is not in itself a bad thing, but both these reactions are not empathetically accurate because they represent a lack of compassion and of inspiration. The war on drugs was a terrible idea, so better late than never. Yeah, okay, let's stop doing that. I got busted for possession of marijuana 50 years to the day, October 17th, before my country officially legalized it. Another coincidence. My family lived in a small city in rural Ontario, And the lawyer asked me why I used the drug, and I told him it was for performance enhancement because I wanted to be a great guitarist. And I said that I also smoked it for relaxation because I worked so hard, wanting like anything to be successful. I'm laughing out loud now, remembering this kindly and wise old Jewish lawyer looking across his huge mahogany desk, looking at me, the long-haired high school dropout son of the local Lutheran minister, and telling me that my rationalizations for taking drugs were utter bullshit. I was tried in adult court and narrowly avoided a 2-year prison sentence, which back then was the norm. Luckily, I got probation. But still, the effects of that arrest and trial on my youthful self, and especially on my family, were awful, and they lasted a lot longer than 2 years. In my home as a kid then, and now again in my present home as an old guy, hearing psychoactive products called a medicine or a performance enhancement, as you refer to cannabis, it just hurts us. And the thing is, our serious discomfort is overwhelmingly more typical than your performance enhancement, even if we're talking about just pot and not the opioid epidemic that is devastating families and communities. And I could go on about online porn and the effect of it on relationships. Rapidly gets to my main point, which is that addiction, whether to mind-altering drugs, behaviors, or both, touches us all, and a conversation about doing drugs should acknowledge such a significant source of suffering. Further to which, I want to talk about two other things that are hugely important to how I understand addictions. The first is personal, and the second is pretty eccentric, so please bear with me. First, the personal, the relationship with my significant other. In uncovering the causes of my relapse, I've had to work hard on my marriage. The pre-existing problems with which both my individual therapist and the couple therapists would think were the sources of my relapse. They're telling me that my relationship was more germane than my long history of addiction, genetic predilection, current pandemic circumstances, whatever. But no, it was the personal relationship. The conglomeration of romantic partners, present, past, significant others, and my deceased mother that done the trick. My recovery process has been very humbling, therefore, and kind of scary, because I thought that with the work I have done and the help I've had over many years, that I'd learn my lessons and diffuse those triggers. Well, I reckon not, and it's interesting how my unclear and troubled state of mind and the lack of silence and solitude during this pandemic time conditioned my misadventure. I got caught in an encrusted, submerged structure, like a skin diver trapped in a wreck. Used to sail the high seas on that ship. Wasn't I the skipper? Yeah, no, it's all on me now. But I still can't see how a person can write a whole book about solitude without ever mentioning being married. Moreover, to the woman who I venture to guess that you gave up being a monk to be with, I'm just guessing, and I shouldn't, but seems like there's a story here. Maybe you fell in love and gave up being a nun and monk to be together. Or was it a bunch of coincidences? Mayhap doctrines and conveniences? Yeah, no, nobody's business but yours and hers, certainly not mine. I originally meant for this letter to focus on drug taking. Also, I felt that I needed to recognize the significance of solitude, silence and self-governance, these spiritual necessities, because these things are all related. And by my lights, they're connected with the story of why we get high. And now I'm saying, moreover, that the orbit of life's conversation is the journey of love that we take with our loved ones and others, because love is still what it's all about. Yes, I realize that I have no equanimity here. I feel like an asteroid's moon, just small. But I get black hole emotional when I talk about love. But the lack thereof happens to me more often than I'd like, that I get angry, I mean, and find myself actually yelling over love. Lots of asteroids have moons, I recently heard, maybe no larger than a shopping mall parking lot. One might swing off and away into space, and it's like a speck of dust. Not even that. Oh, my God. But for sure, good conversation truly helps. And I hope that my being such a nosy and emotional, not to mention wildly digressive person, isn't a complete turnoff to the people who I'd like to hear from, like you especially, Stephen. Because there's still this second talking point I'd like to share, if you'll forbear. And it's about how, if we're talking about a skillfully compassionate reset of the Buddhist precepts against sex and drugs, orthodox puritanical rules that are non-operational in today's society, our being skillful requires more than a reconciliation with both the relational and the religious aspects of our species' nature. We also need to try to bear in mind a hard problem. And I'm not talking about the hard problem, consciousness. I'm talking about what I regard as a similarly hard problem, time. I say similarly because I really don't know, and just because two things, consciousness and time, for example, are both great mysteries, that doesn't mean they're both the same great mystery. This is an easy mistake to make. I made it with quantum physics, spirituality, and consciousness. And now here I go again, maybe, because I want to try something about capital T, time. I know I'm eccentric, but I just really want to imagine the possibilities for thinking very differently about time in relation to love, spirituality, and addiction. So what is time anyway, this great mystery? Time in the cosmos, real time. Real time hyphenated more often, as in real time meeting, and soon it will be written as just one word, real time. Supposedly here and now time. I really don't know what it is, but still I feel it's amazingly important. I used to think that with the Buddhist insight regarding non-self, that with recognizing the pregnant and clinging error of identification in self-making, I could believe that our concept of time, our sensible error, was an accessory attached to that self-same self-making, and that therefore the false subject self and the sense of time that comes along with it were logically upstream of those aforementioned other two most significantly naturally selected human characteristics, our sociability and our religiosity. I used to think this was all neatly true, back in the day when I also believed that we stand on the banks of time, which like a river flows past us. Physics says that's not correct. Apparently time doesn't pass. We do. We all pass away, but time just is. We try to make it out to be a resource at our disposal, but maybe that's just totally wrong. And instead of our having time, we are time. We're like units of time. So now I really don't know. Don't know how to think about time. Contemplating astrophysics, a person really has to wonder what's true. And mindful of Buddhist insight, a person will wonder who's wondering. And now in this pandemic time, temporality has especially got everyone's attention now when the future just ain't what it used to be. And when, like everyone, I'm as totally bewildered as I am overinformed, and that's on a good day. Somebody tells me I'm overthinking all this and that everyone should just live in the moment. To me, that's just a totally paradoxical notion. Like, where's there a free will to be anywhere else? What's more, if not in the present, then when else is the past? Because for sure, it's not passed away. That's what they say in Ireland. The thing about the past is, it's not past. And where and when else but now in our minds lives a future that we can or even should stop thinking about? It's all happening, right here, right now. Past and future just take their rightful places, right along with everything, in punctuate consciousness, right now, on and on. And the thought of 8 billion brains all seeking out some otherly metaphysical moment, naming it now, and trying to plant a flag on it is as incoherent as it is frightening. Even before the flame vaporizes the substance and the fumes of the dissolving rock of crack cocaine get sucked into the body's bloodstream, the brain has already exploded in sweet anticipation. This phenomenon. An expectation of imminent pleasure served up with a side order of astonishment has something very interesting in common with how we enjoy music. Because this confection of expectation and surprise is the same neural process that makes it possible to domesticate noise, to turn the chaotic din into wonderful art. Music, at least from the point of view of what happens in the brain, is the experience of expecting something to happen and then having it play on us in a unique and pleasantly surprising way. So the thing is, whether in taking drugs or making music, what's essential is sweet anticipation. It feels weird to me now to look back recognizing this similarity in both my drug tripping and my music making, how I was play-acting myself in future time. Weird the way for decades I found them both so bloody affectionate. A polymath of early German Romanticism, Novalis, said that all diseases are musical problems and all cures are musical solutions. Well, we don't know what he was talking about either. I sometimes wonder how my addiction counselors remember me. I once tried to count up how many addiction treatment counselors worked on me, and I stopped counting at 44. I wonder how many would remember a story of mine, totally a trope. I called it One Last Time. This one last time, the last use before quitting, just one more. It was a really great time. In fact, it was the best time. The anticipation of letting go, forgetting about all this bullshit and making myself totally available for some new amazement that was coming at me from wherever, everywhere. Because with this, every time I set it up, there was a sense of something big coming up here. Which is exactly what I used to say, because I always relapsed. I'd say it again and again, believing in it again and again. Because one last time was always about adding something to the excitement of using. It was never about actually quitting, abstaining, or renouncing. Incorporating a wink and a nod, a bow to a sober future enabled my skipping off to relive the lie that denied that very future. Because face on, the thought of having to change was way more frightening than the thought of, for example, dying of an overdose. Death was bittersweet. It was a player's risk. What terrified me was the thought of actually running out of this stuff, of crack or whatever. So I needed a go-around that I could believe in, some pretense to protect me from a time when the person I will become will have to endure the effects of the person I am now. One last time was my personal favorite pretense. This is not just about me and drugs. It's about nations perpetually growing their economies. It's about our making long-term investments in fossil fuel extraction while we nod to the science of climate change. It's about constructing invulnerable social media identities while we tell our kids that they should be in touch with their feelings, especially empathy. We've got major addictions, and we don't want to take responsibility for the consequences of our appetites. What limited sense of time we once had is getting totally skewed by compounding and conflicting cravings. Are we so different from the millions of Americans who've fallen in with QAnon? Despite what their leaders said would happen, didn't happen, and won't ever happen, they can, like every other prophecy cult in history, just reset their key date and ramp up their beliefs. QAnon has already done this several times in only a few years. The storm is coming, say they. And so long as they keep repeating it, their membership just keeps on growing. Because their internet sites, like crack houses and thousands of places of worship, are crowded with expectant believers waiting for the big event that will make everything okay again. For going on 15 years of my being clean, I thought I was cured of all my addictions, and then I relapsed. I'd spun a good story of addiction and recovery, but as is most often the case with stories, when you factor out the bad luck and the good luck, what's left is mainly the conceits of the storyteller. Stories are bundles of lies. But okay, never mind that. This time for sure, I promise to never again hide in the false protection of such pretense. I admit that good luck is the main reason my addictions didn't kill me. By sheer luck, I recovered and had the resources to uncover the roots of my issues. So now I'm here and doing well, lucky for me. But for very sure now, I don't want the combination of blind luck and pretense to be the platform I stand on. Neither should anybody who is lucky enough to be alive. I detect another faint echo of blind luck and pretense when I hear advocates of ayahuasca saying that it's a one-shot deal, describing it as the opposite of Freudian psychoanalysis. One-shot deals, breakthroughs, aha moments, and enlightenment, I'm skeptical. But seekers will abide. I'm not a seeker, but still I reckon we'll see what happens, at least until we don't or can't see anymore because we're gone. Perhaps gone not because extinct, but because we've changed beyond what we now recognize as our natural and normal selves, which might be a terrible fate or it might be very okay. Depends, but whatever. Won't be the first time ourselves and the world have been irrevocably altered. Given time, for example, for confronting global warming instead of we just get whacked by a meteorite, a new theory of addiction would definitely be useful, and I think fascinating, to better understand how we do and undo habits. And also, and I think similarly important, how do the ways we relate to one another change when we're orbiting around an addiction? The warp and weft of relationships is the cosmic tissue. When is the time to repair? When the time to rip asunder? When is the healing time? I don't know, but it's interesting. There's an old saying, pertains to me. Give a man a hammer, and pretty soon everything he sees is a nail. And I'm still here with my hammer, trying to deconstruct my sex and drug habit. Turn my history into stories and theories. Thing is that in this season of life, I'm mostly using my hammer's claw end. A really clear view of addictions would uncover human nature's capacity to change habits and restore relationships. Would be good to be seeing and hearing things differently, before it gets too dark to dance or too warm, not just for old addicts like me, but for all beings on this timely planet. I listened to 10,000 check-ins, my cohorts in addictions therapy talking about their predicaments. I remember the time in group, I realized, said out loud, we're all lonely as hell. Still think it's true. Addictions are all about losing in love. Not demon drugs, bad genes, capitalism, dislocation, homelessness. Not the parents, the schools, the legal system. Not trauma, pre and postnatal. Yeah, for sure, all those things, but still, always, the commonest thing is loneliness, brokenheartedness. I'm still listening to addictions, and that's what I'm still hearing about how it all went wrong. I guess one thing about my web platform is that I don't have an editor. So now nobody will stop me from sharing my latest odd and embarrassing thought. Maybe it's a kind of crazy longing, which I confess I'm following up in books and podcasts. I wish that we could meet extraterrestrials. Okay, I said it out loud, and it sounds flaky and puerile, but yeah, I'd really like for humans to somehow hook up. I mean, like, start up a conversation with beings from another planet. Their existence is highly probable, so where is everybody? I imagine the way a meeting would go is that we'd have a little laugh over the Fermi paradox. Our new BFF is wonderfully kind and good-humored, and so then we'd get right down to the business of asking for help. Maybe they were once upon a time lonely, lost creatures too. I don't know. But for reasons I can't explain, I just really like to ask someone who's super smart and not human if he, she, they, or whatever thinks it's because of our being lonely that we keep on choosing to build bad habits into addictions. Because as far as I can tell, no one on Earth has figured it out. So I'd like to ask they if they think our loneliness has something to do with why at times we go off by ourselves. Is it because there just ain't no cure for love? It don't matter how it all went wrong. That'll change the way I feel. Maybe I could share with they a verse from this song by Leonard Cohen. All the rocket ships are climbing through the sky. The holy books are open wide. The doctors working day and night, but they'll never ever find that cure for love. There ain't no drink, no drug, tell them angels. There is no cure for love, no cure for love. And I can't believe that time is going to heal the wound that I'm speaking of, shouting of, sometimes singing of. The curation requires creative expression, and deep wounds, lost love, also need silence and solitude for the non-story of healing that allows our better angels their timely shining. I accept that there may be a right time for taking mind-altering products, when some people might find them helpful, in extraordinary situations, whether that be in ceremonies and circles around fires guided by elders or in treatment centers run by psychiatrists, I don't know. Seems to me that the old school is a better bet than the medicalized model. No doubt it all depends, though. But I don't believe that psychoactive, psychotropic drugs are in themselves liberative, redemptive, or curative. I'm actually pretty okay with the Buddhist orthodox precept that it's just not good to take drugs. Probably I think that's basically true. And what's wrong with me saying so, except that there's nobody else around here who agrees? And I get it, because for Christ's sake, I'm advocating feeling bored, sad, and lonesome in a world where escaping those feelings and self-administered chemical intoxication is almost completely normalized. The admonition against drinking and driving and the age restrictions on alcohol consumption are exceptions that prove the rule. If you are an adult and not behind the wheel, go right ahead and enjoy as advertised. The choice to get high on your drug of choice is on its way to being enshrined as a right, conflated with life, liberty, and happiness. And in my opinion, this choice is unhealthy and immoral, because along with the extremely pleasurable buzz comes deprivation of nourishment to the soul. And because consumer hedonism's conceit of invulnerability discounts empathy. When I wish someone good luck, that includes my hope that they'll not be getting high, let alone not get hooked and do great harm to their loved ones. People told me a lie about addictions when I was young. They said that a person's nature doesn't change, and that for some of us, for example, we're just stoners. That if people like me take those drugs, we won't be able to quit. Demon drugs. Disease-prone people. Just do the math and say no. And what I took from that is that I might just as well go crazy because what I might otherwise try to do doesn't really matter. Meaning, I don't really matter. Might as well write my sober reality off. And so if drugs and sex relieve my pain and bring on bliss, even very temporarily, just say yes. I remember in a comic strip, Lucy counseling Charlie Brown. She said, "Your problem, Charlie Brown, is that you're you." That's the lie, and people are still saying it. And what's behind it is the idea that for some of us, there's no capacity for spiritual freedom. But the truth is, there is, for everyone. For everyone, and at all times, including and instead of happy hour. And even if none of us can be totally cured of all what we suffer, we can all be well curated, always and urgently. The soul deserves our care. We can make art forms of our lives in solitude and together in community. Our earliest human ancestors went deep into caves to draw on walls. I read in a book by E.O. Wilson that every one of those more than 200 known sites of Paleolithic cave paintings has acoustics the quality of a concert hall. Remnants of musical instruments are found in those places. People were doing something together in places difficult to reach, in ceremony and art, curating their lives and inner selves, their fears, their dreams. They had beer and most likely other drugs. Whether human communion required those products then, I don't know, but I definitely believe we're better off without them now. The ways of being spiritually free are always changing. I imagine that for our prehistoric forebears, there was a sense of being in the right time and place for their real-time veneration of collective memory and mystery. That they were sharing something essential and auspicious is what I like to imagine. In our postmodern notions of time and place, time is a knot, and space is in non-material flows. All of a sudden, we've wired ourselves up in this crazy, humongous media experiment in which everyone is the subject, everybody and nobody is running the show, and who can say for sure what's coming down the pipe next? Because the supply chain logistics of our everyday situation are no good for understanding what we're becoming. So I ask, what kinds of tripping can be beneficial, let alone auspicious, in this bewildered world into which we arrive socially disconnected and we stay totally and continually distracted from cradle to grave, surrounded by highly processed drugs, distilled alcohols, and a kaleidoscope of colored pixels on beeping and ringing devices? I think we have to come to grips with the fact that the situation has really changed. The intoxicants are different, and so are we. Maybe 10, 20, 30,000 years ago, getting high and getting it together were beautifully aligned, but I think it's possible that that stopped being reliably true sometime around 500 BC, when new insights into the nature of things came along. Our bad luck that organized religions came along around then, too, to wage their wars against curiosity and good humor, banning the drugs, murdering the witches. The war on drugs was just the most recent of such reactions. All this religious negativity has given renunciation and sobriety an undeserved bad rap. And could be even worse luck now, when a near total misalignment of mind, body, and spirit is in hyper-capitalist overdrive. Oh my God, I'm like the Grinch who stole Christmas, I know. I'm an old curmudgeon. And I really don't know, but I'm thinking about this. In classical Greece, the care and feeding of the soul was called eudaimonia, practiced in solitude and in communion fulfilled. Seems again like a good idea, talking about revolution for the new generation. And Stephen, just one more thing, one more coincidence. On the morning after reading your chapter on Vermeer, you say you were wondering if something you read about one of his paintings when you were 18 had somehow stayed with you and guided you to your writing at age 68. And then this morning of mine, my age 68 self, was sitting on the can reading Tricycle, the Buddhist Review. And I was reading a beautiful article called Living in a World That No Longer Exists by Curtis White, who's talking about the very same painting, Vermeer's Woman Holding a Balance. Nice coincidence. Two very excellent writer teachers telling me about a Dutch Golden Age masterpiece, which depicts a householder woman who is looking, her face is equanimous and enigmatic, calm, lovely, and compelling, framed by the hood of a fur-trimmed jacket, rich white fur, maybe winter or mine. Her eyes are hooded, lowered to take in the empty balance which she's holding in her hand, and on her table the strings of pearls, a gold chain, the deep indigo jeweler's felt. White quotes 13th century master Dogen. "Enlightenment is the intimacy of all things," said Dogen. Coincidence and luck are my keys to this intimacy that is unlocked by paying attention, feeling amazement. Because look at us here. Look where we are. All alive, taking another breath. When doesn't it seem so much more likely there'd be no existence? In either way, nothing personal, but still, enlightenment is the intimacy of all things. Dogen's philosophy, Uji, is typically translated as being time. The title of Heidegger's magnum opus is Being in Time. So much in common, despite their centuries and cultures apart. But I like Dogen better because he didn't join the Nazi party. And so aren't we all still here now, wondering how the person who we were some time ago might be recognizable as a pilgrim on a path to the person we will one day become? Faith today is gratitude for choices that might grace that meeting. Time to take a breather here. I want to wish you good day, Stephen Batchelor. But just one postscript. You've once again provided your followers with an erudite and thought-provoking book, this one devoted to the art of being in solitude. And this important work has really helped me. For it and for all the books you've written, I want to say thank you for being such a positive and wholesome influence. I'm urging you to update your views on drugs, especially in the context of relationships, and to expand the lens to recognize addictions. But I think everything you've said and done is truly helpful. And so now I've been inspired to launch this podcast site devoted to uncovering addictions and to the art of being just very okay alone together, I guess now or never, whatever. And for the sake of whatever, I'd just like to lastly ask, is there a common root of the mystical and the artistic that might be found in the quality of our practicing, of knowing practice in a state of grace? Because I'm quite sure that practicing an artfully curated way of living intrinsically involves ethical behavior, by which I mean performing honorably, and for elders especially to be guiding their communities with integrity, not fucking up like Heidegger and Trungpa, and also Bill, who founded Alcoholics Anonymous, him too. Other names in Buddhism come to mind, too many. And just yesterday, I read that Thomas Merton, for fuck's sake, Thomas Merton, celibate monk and exceptionally prolific writer, had a son he didn't care for, didn't speak to, and apparently didn't get around to mentioning in all those books and letters. And I just don't get it. You don't go there. I don't go there. Even stowed out of my mind, I wasn't that bad. Most of my problems were just the result of gross stupidity. I really don't get how such wise people can be so unkind. Buddhists sometimes describe wisdom and compassion as a pair of wings, and that flight requires they be balanced, right up there along with other higher order dialectics, the spiritual versus the secular, the ultimate versus the relative, the solitary sitting versus life's crazy circus parade, mounted in opposition, but wanting to be held in balance, high in the air. My sense is that this model is useless. I mean, why is living an examined life seen as a compromise between conflicting forces? Of course, living mindfully can be as difficult as it is urgently necessary, but aren't there usually better non-binary ways to relate to things? Ways that lead to a consensus when the complicated values of an issue seem to be drawing things apart, pulling me away? And anyway, who's the aviator in this cockpit on any given day? I wish I could ask you in person, what do you think? I'd like to know what you'd say to my suggesting that the real story is that there's actually just one wing. That this is it. The wing is everything and including all versions of me, and the wing has a certain shape to it. A foil shape that splits the air and in motion, by a miracle of nature, generates lift. This is Bernoulli's principle, so-called since 1738, when it was recognized by science. This miracle that lifts a bird's body, an airplane's fuselage, a sailing vessel, into the vacuum on the side of the wing that represents the longer trip from the leading edge to the trailing edge. And what a miracle it is, because the separated molecules of air journeying from the windward to the far leeward end, the point to which these divided elements want, amazingly they appear to desire to reconnect. Why should molecules of air care about it? I don't understand. I wonder if being mystified about it has to do with the misunderstanding of time. I wonder if that's the reality of where this miracle lies, that maybe it's not a where miracle, but a when miracle. But I really don't know, because my goodness, what it seems like now is that the molecules are on a mass pilgrimage, all of them looking to arrive at the same place at the same time for the meeting. And what a coincidence, because here we are. Here I am. Here you are. And that's just the way it is when you're a foil, Stephen Batchelor. Take care. Have a good day.